would like to do that.
Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery with you this weekend. For those of you who have been participating here since the beginning, I just want to tell you, if you have attention deficit disorder and you get through listening before I'm done talking, you just feel free to leave. It has been a very busy weekend. You pack an awful lot into an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, I can tell you that. I want to thank Kathy for meeting me at the airport yesterday and giving me a walking tour of the Denver airport parking lot. She could not have parked any further from the baggage claim than she did, and we were walking through and walking and walking and walking through the parking lot. She seemed to know where she was going, and I was following about 12 steps behind because I was having a little trouble breathing. I live at sea level. And she apparently, we found the truck, so she did obviously know where we were going 7.5 miles after we started from... So I'd like to thank her for that. I was having a problem last night. I was exhausted, and I couldn't figure out why. I thought I'd been bit by a tsetse fly or something. I was just having a really hard time staying awake, and then I thought, well, it must have been the pasta. The cheese was too rich. I mean, I'm very anal. I try and figure these things out. And then somebody finally suggested it was at the altitude, and they suggested I drink a ton of water. And so I've been drinking a ton of water. Now I'm still tired, but I have to pee all the time. So anyway, they assured me I would get used to the altitude just about the time I landed at LAX tomorrow. So I'm grateful for that. I often wonder how I should start my talk, and you know, when I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, I already started it, so... But I was in the Al-Anon meeting, I was sitting over there, and I was listening to Dolores, and I was, of course, every once in a while, I'd look up at that big screen. I was not thinking about Dolores, I was thinking about me, and wondering if I had time to go have a facial before I got up here. That is just a little intimidating, I want to tell you. On the other hand, it could be a good thing. I did take everything out of my pockets. I have a tendency to touch myself while I'm talking. And at other times, too, just depending on my mood. But... one time I was talking at an AA event, and I was touching myself, and I was, you know, kind of having a good time, and I had a lighter in my pocket, and somehow the lighter ignited, and I was wearing silk that evening, and I don't know if you're familiar with silk, but it ignites really quickly, and one spark in that lighter, and I just, it burst into flames behind the podium, and I am CPR first aid certified, so I know it's stop, drop, and roll. I'm also a compulsive talker, so as I was going to the floor, I grabbed the microphone, and I just kept talking while I rolled myself out, and stood back up, mostly naked, and finished my talk. I was thinking while I was sitting here, because I think all the time. That was one of the things that worried me about this altitude business. I was, of course, been obsessed wondering if I'm getting enough oxygen to my brain. Because I think all the time, and when your lack of oxygen could slow down my thinking process. So I was concentrating on how well I was thinking so I would know if the altitude was really affecting me. And I was thinking about... See, a number of years ago, I was loitering around in a drugstore. I like to loiter around the pharmacy area where they're dispensing the medication. And I was I watch them get their pills, you know, in the different colors, and I fantasize about what that stuff would do. And I was loitering around there, and as I was loitering, I noticed there was a display of seeds. There were vegetable and fruit seeds, and they were on sale, 10 packs for a dollar. And I thought, you know, I've never had a hobby. People in AA are always talking about their hobbies, and I've never really had a hobby. Maybe I could have a garden. It would be like a really cool hobby. So I thought about what 10 packets of seeds to buy. It was a big decision, and it took me, oh, probably an hour before I finally picked the 10 packs of seeds that I was going to start my new hobby, my garden, with. I bought the seeds. I went home. I went out to my backyard, and I was looking around the backyard trying to decide where to put my garden. Well, the backyard was pretty well growing with things. And there really wasn't any place for my garden, but I had a slope that ran the length of my property, and there was nothing growing on the slope, and I thought, well, that would be a good place for my garden. But then I had a little concern, because I thought, if I plant the seeds in the slope, when I water it, how am I going to know that the water actually goes down to the seeds? I mean, it'll just roll off the slope, and I won't really know if it's going down to the seeds or not. So I pondered that for a while, and I'm not a mason, but I figured if I went to Home Depot and got a truckload of brick, I could build a wall. So I went and got this brick, and I built a retaining wall. And, you know, if you're not a mason, mixing up that cement is really difficult to get it to the right consistency. And you really should not try putting it on that scaffold and throwing it up and catching it and slapping it down on the brick. I think that takes a lot of practice, but I'm building this wall, and I built it, and I have my disease manifest itself. I tend to start quick, but then I get bored. And I kind of got bored a little too soon with this wall, but I finished the wall, and when I looked at it, it wasn't real straight. It was kind of had some curves in it, but if you put a lot of stucco on it, you can straighten it right out. So I stucco the heck out of that thing, and I got it straightened out. And then I bought a truckload of dirt, and I filled it in because I was going to, like, level off my slope. Well, I had pooped out on the brick thing a little early, and so when I filled it in with dirt, it still sloped. It wasn't as severe, but it was still a slope. So I went to Home Depot and got another truckload of brick, and about halfway up, I built another wall, so I had a tiered garden. When I got done with that, I'm looking at it, and then I start thinking, you know, I'm not home a lot. I work a full-time job. I go to AA meetings every night. I sponsor women. I'm away from home a lot of weekends. Who's going to water my garden? So I'm not a plumber, but I tapped into the water main. And I brought a water line out to my new garden area, and I laid some drip hose in my garden. So I figured that way it could get water. I'm not an electrician, but I tapped into the electric, and I brought electricity out there so that I could put a timer on the whole thing, so that the timer could be set and my garden would be watered. And I figured as long as I'm bringing electricity out, I might as well put some Malibu lights just for... I put the Malibu lights, planted my seeds. It cost me thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to plant a dollar's worth of seeds. And the reason I tell you that story is because I suffer from alcoholism. I don't suffer from alcoholism. I suffer from alcoholism, and I have alcoholism as badly tonight as I did the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I need you more tonight than I needed you the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my disease manifests itself differently on a daily basis. But I have alcoholism, so I am so grateful that me and my alcoholism are with you this weekend, so that I can get the solutions to the events in my life, so that I have an opportunity to live successfully out there. And that's why I come here, is so that I can live successfully out in the world. My sponsor tells me when I do this, I should tell you my name and tell you the truth. I've already told you my name. I'm not so certain I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that is obvious to me. I mean, I didn't know when I was out there practicing, which I think is a really bizarre word for what we do, I needed no practice. I am really, really good at drinking. But when I was out there, I didn't know that what it used to be like was going to be important. When I was out there, I didn't know... I didn't know that I was going to be expected to report to you what it used to be like. If I would have known I was going to be here tonight, expected to report to you, I would have paid more attention to my life. If I would have known... Well, if I'd have known about a fourth and fifth step, I can guarantee you I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know that what it used to be like was going to be important. So what I share with you is my perspective of what it used to be like. A lot of what I share with you has been reported to me by other people. And I just have to assume they're telling me the truth. I have a job that I had to get a fingerprint clearance. And when I was... I fingerprint really, really well. I know how to fingerprint. I just know exactly how to roll with it. It's just an easy, sleazy... But I was being fingerprinted, and I didn't want to raise any red flags, so I said to the woman who was printing me, I said, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. The book says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. And I thought, hey, yeah, yeah, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order, because they're going to know about it before I do. And I can tell you, I know a lot more about what it used to be like having had that clearance than I knew before I was fingerprinted. So a lot of this has just been reported to me by other people, and I'm just going to believe that it's the truth. I didn't have my first drink until I was 13 years old. I'm really sorry I waited that long, but I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. As far as I know, I had I just didn't know anything about alcohol. I had never made any I'm never going to drink promises, and I had never had any oh, I can't wait until I can drink ideas. I just never thought about alcohol one way or another. And yet, when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip at the beach in Southern California, and I remember when we got into the tent that night, I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where it came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God, but I can never be sure. But I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted it, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent, and nothing had got different, nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again... Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard you talk about your first drink, and you talked about taking the drink. And you talked about you felt it in your mouth, and you described it as you felt it go down your throat. And you talked about it hitting your stomach, and you described how it exploded from your stomach and went to your fingernails and your toenails, and you talked about your pimples falling off, and you grew up 2 or 3 inches, and you lost 20 pounds, and you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you. And that wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief tonight that if you were to drink a quart of anything, in about 15 minutes, you would have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled down to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I did discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that at 13, so I sat there, and I intuitively knew that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured that if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I suppose it was my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all in one place, and it seemed to be sort of centrally located, I just fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, of course, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines, I'd be dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety, and if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to say that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I think under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. It was the most wonderful, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, fabulous spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He said, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a weakness. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. I'm the kind of person that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. And I don't know, this is unusual. I don't know there's anything unusual about this. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body. And from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. And I don't know that I'm living any different than anybody else. And when you think about it, how would we know? I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, an alley drinker, car drinker, a dumpster drinker, an office drinker. I mean, an alley drinker. I didn't really specialize. I just drank. But I love bars, and I love sleazy, sleazy, nasty bars. I love those kind of bars that have sawdust on the floor. I like them when the mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. I like them when they're full of smoke, and they have that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still when I think of it. I love that. I love that smell. But you know what fascinates me about those sleazy places? In retrospect, I am fascinated by the quality of people who drank there. There were CEOs of really big companies. There were bank presidents. There were admirals in the Air Force. There were neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were. I never told a lie in a bar. But we weren't sitting around there having conversations like, "What do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aquavelva?" We weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I had an opportunity to go to college. I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. I share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. As a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, I'm drinking on a daily basis, and I graduate from college with a 3.8 grade point average. And when I came here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I got my degree. I stayed at San Diego State and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego State because I'd been offered a job in Chico, California, which is as far north as you can get and still be in California. And that's the reason I left school and put everything I owned in my car, took two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got 80 miles north of San Diego, and I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleepiest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got, 80 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support, and at some point it had turned, and I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink, but at some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, honesty, integrity, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings, and by the time I got here, it had taken it all, and I didn't have a clue. I got a job in the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that too almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about, I was in the newspaper business, and I know tonight it was because God gave me a gift. We often won awards, but we also were a community paper, so we often gave awards. And what I didn't tell you about was the times that I would come out of a blackout, standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people, holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. And by the way, I love blackouts. I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I don't understand people who come to AA in a panic. And they're in a meeting, and they're panicking, and they're talking about, last night I was in a bar, and I looked at my watch, and it was 1:30. Next thing I knew, it was 2:15. I don't know where that 45 minutes went. I know my life's unmanageable. I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me work the 12 steps so I can recover. I don't understand that. I love blackouts. There was nothing more exciting to me than leaving work on August 2nd, going back to work on August 14th, and discovering I'd been there the entire time. It makes the time between paychecks really short. I wish I could have blackouts sober. I love blackouts, but the blackouts didn't bother me at all. Bring on the blackouts. I arrived in... and I have to tell you this, I'm having a major hot flash. Carl talked about taking his hearing aids off. I will take my clothes off. I'm telling you. No booze is one thing. No booze and no estrogen will kill you. I'm telling you, I don't mind bearing children, but I think men ought to go through menopause. Well, I got sidetracked. Now you have way more information about me than you need to have, I'm sure. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous was I discovered you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing. I'm driving down the street. I am always minding my own business, and I don't know why the cops are always looking for me. But I'm driving down the street, and the light comes on behind me, and I pull over. The officer walks up to the car door, and the first thing I do is slam the car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts, but men are a little fussy about their private parts, so as the door's flying open, he jumps back. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing, because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try. And I would go out the car for him, and it would be a really good fight for a couple of minutes. Now, I was a lot younger then, but it was a really good fight. But I would never remember that he had a friend back at the car. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends, and pretty soon it'd be three or four of them, one of me. Well, now it's not fair anymore, and I say, Uncle. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over, the officer walks up, I slam the car door open, he jumps back, he gets far enough away, I can get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I would go for him. And it would be a good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend in the radio and the friend's friend. Pretty soon it'd be four or five of them, one of me, it's not fair anymore, I say, Uncle. the next time the light comes on. And I don't do that one, two, or two times. I do that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. I never remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And when you do that, they don't care that they won the fight. They attach an assault charge. Drunk driving assault. And I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I always get the arrest report, and I read it. And I find out where I made my mistake. So that I can practice that part, so that next time I'll get that part right. I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew because it was you and they and them. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was a lot of things. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. Absolutely never occurred to me that it had anything to do with alcohol. So I practice field sobriety tests a lot. I am really good at field sobriety tests. And on what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault, I was doing really well. In fact, I had commented to the officer that I thought he should give me an A+. I mean, by then I knew how to walk. I knew touch your finger to your nose meant this. It didn't mean that. And I was doing a swell job. Now, at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, right? So this time when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around and See, you think it's funny. He wasn't even mildly amused. I was turned around, he cuffed me, he took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And up until that time, I had not suffered any consequences from drunk driving. In the state of California, I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but they just didn't have their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. But, I mean, I've lost my driver's license, but so what? I never had a problem driving a car without it. I had a little difficulty cashing a check, but it was never difficult to drive a car. But I never really had any other consequences. But at the end of my drinking, the state of California was getting in their underwear in a knot about people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing a .42 on their breathalyzer, and they were really getting upset. So at my last one, I was 26 years old. I was in court, drunk. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to the grocery store, to work, the laundromat, to school. It's the only way I did anything. Stood there drunk that morning, being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed and the tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of sentencing me, he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you that I left the courtroom, I came here, I looked at the 12 steps, I knew they were the solution to the problems of my life. I worked them all in a week and skyrocketed to recovery. Sometimes I do tell that, but that is not my story. I stood there and I thought about it. Jail alternative. Trying to make a decision. The public defender's putting his elbow in my ribs and I'm thinking, jail alternative. And in that, while I was trying to figure it out, I had what I know tonight was a moment of clarity, because as clear as I knew anything, I knew that morning that if I went to jail, I would either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. And I didn't know why I knew that morning, but I knew it as clear as anything. And I took the alternative and I left the courtroom and I drank for 4 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency that I had never known before. And I drank with a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing, what the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a speaker meeting, and as far as I know, I'd never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. And I went to the meeting that night, and I sat in the back of the room, and I cannot tell you who talked that night. But I heard two things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around and I didn't see any of them drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? This made me this made me really nervous, and I cannot figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to the Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. The other thing that I heard was that the answers were in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was, because when I got home that night, I read that book. Not only could I not find the answers in there, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. I don't think it matters why you come back. I think what's important is that you come back. I don't think it matters what your motive is or what your intention is. I think it matters what your action is. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you, unless you're sleeping with them. What is it? I mean, I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants. Not like I don't know about the kids in Colorado, but I work with kids. I work with teenagers who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They wear pants that are so big, I'm forever telling them they could put a homeless family in there with them. But his weren't quite that baggy, but they were baggy. And he had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, only the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he was shooting heroin, because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And I could probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day went down to his office, and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I'll guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my relationships would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. It's a little hope for the newcomer and his former wife. But as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. And every area of my life is different than it was the day I walked the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. My perception, and this may or may not be true, this is just my perception of my life. People hurt me all my life. People disappointed me and they let me down. My parents told me they loved me anymore, their love and I to die. Their love was physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive. As a small child, I came to know that you would not be there for me. If you told me you would do something, you weren't going to do it. As a small child, I learned that people hurt you. And as a small child, I made a decision, I don't want to be hurt anymore. And so as a small child, I began to build a wall between me and you. And I built a big brick wall between me and you because I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. And that wall kept you out. What I never knew about that wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you live behind a big wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. But for some reason that morning, I believed that old man. And I hadn't believed another human being in a very long time. And I need to tell you, that old man who I thought was shooting heroin, the truth was is he was sober longer than I'd been alive. And the reason that he nodded out in meetings is he had something inside that I didn't have a clue as to what it was. He had a serenity and a peace inside. He was right with us, he was right with God, and he was right with himself, and I didn't have a clue as to what that was. But I believed him, and I had the book, so every night I'd open it to chapter 3, and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I would go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. So I went to the 2 meetings a week my court program said I had to go to, and the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I was not a happy newcomer. The book talks about we become restless, irritable, and discontent. That's an understatement to what I became. The only thing I knew was anger, and I acted it out in violence. I would sit in the back of a meeting, the speaker would be sharing, I didn't like what they were saying, I'd jump up and I would let them know exactly what I thought of what they were saying. It was usually like these string of profanities, but I put them together in such a way that it sounded like a sentence. And I would just spew it out from the back of the room, and then some little old blue-haired lady would turn around and smile and say, keep coming back, and I'd... her off, I'd wave my court card in her face and I would tell her I didn't have a choice, and I would sit back down until it went off again, and I carried a knife in my boot, I would pull it out, I just wanted a reaction. If somebody would react, I'd clean my fingernails. If nobody reacted, I threw it across the room at the literature rack. I always aimed at the piece of literature a member's eye view. I didn't always hit it, but that's what I aimed for. One night a guy shared, he irritated me, and saying, I jumped him after the meeting, I was beating his head into the concrete floor. Took 6 guys to get me off of him, and I knew they were going to tell me I had to leave. I thought you had to get I was trying to get thrown out. It never occurred to me just not to come back. And when those guys got me off of him, one of those men looked at me and he said, Patty, next time you feel that volcano about to explode, so just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another human being. And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. Nobody had ever talked to me about the volcano before, but that's what I had inside of me. I had a volcano, and when it erupted, I had to do something. When it erupted, I wanted to see blood, preferably yours. When it erupted, I didn't seem to have any control. And I had to walk around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time with my hands in my pockets to discover that that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of me. And I had survived in places where you can't survive if you're afraid. And a long time ago, I began to cover that fear with anger and acted out in violence. And that's all I knew when I got here. But I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. 8.5 months away from my last drink, the pain of not drinking and not recovering drove me to my knees. I think the greatest pain that I have ever suffered, and I've been in pain in the last 25 years, I somehow thought, and nobody gave me this information, I just made it up, a lot of things that I think are true, I make up. The difference today is I usually check it with you because most of the time my solutions are worse than the problem. So, but early on, I thought that if I worked the steps really, really hard with enough passion, if I really, really worked the steps, I would somehow sort of soar above humanness. I would somehow be soaring up here where I would never experience anything that I judged as negative. I would never have a feeling that I judged as negative. I would never have any fear, insecurity, self-doubt, I'd never have a flat tire. It would just be like life would be grand. The truth for me in working the steps is I've come into my humanness. And as a human being, I sometimes experience fear, self-doubt. As a human being, sometimes life is painful. But I have never in 25 years experienced the depths of pain that I experienced 8.5 months of not drinking and not recovering. And that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. That wherever I ingest alcohol, I'm damned to continue to live the same way, day after day after day. That when I drink alcohol, I have no choices. When I drink alcohol, alcohol runs every area of my life. Alcohol controls where I'll live, where I'll work, where I'll play, the people I'll run with, and eventually the people I'll run from. I have no choices in my life. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. That's the powerlessness, and that's my unmanageability. I have no choices in my life when I drink. Alcohol manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial. When I drink alcohol, I lose, period. And that was the first step for me, and it took 8.5 months of not drinking for me to get far enough away to see the evidence. You all saw when I came in, it was piled this high. But you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do until the pain of not drinking and not recovering drove me to my knees. I want to talk about the steps because for me, that's what happened. What it was like, I think we all have the same story. We just acted it out a little bit differently. What happened for me is the 12 steps of recovery. There is no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975 to where I am tonight, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps. And this is just my experience. If you have another experience, talk to your sponsor, but this is... This is just my experience. And for those of you who are wondering, we will be done on time. I know this is just a little, like, intermission between dinner and the dance, so not to worry. I'm a loner by nature. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change your nature. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is it's given me the courage and strength to do the things I need to do in spite of my nature. But I'm a loner by nature. Left to my own devices, I prefer to be alone. I hear people say an alcoholic alone is in bad company. I don't believe that. I really am in good company when I'm by myself. I entertain myself beyond anything any of you could ever do for me. I love to read. I like to fish. Well, I like to throw and reel. I'm not big on catching because then you have to touch the fish, which is kind of nasty. But you know you're a loner if you don't like AA potlucks. That's generally the indicator. The book talks about we become disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. I never became that way. It started out that way. I have, over the last 25 years, I have developed one social skill. I used it about 2 this afternoon. I'm fresh out. I have no more. And I used to say I have no problem with God, but the truth is I have one problem with God. I believe we are all God's children, and I've always wanted to be an only child. That's, that's the only problem I have with God. But for me being a loner, coming to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, for me, the power greater than myself was not God. Because you see, being a loner, if I had come to believe that God was going to restore me to sanity, I would have sat on my couch, which is where I prefer to be. God would have flown in, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to hang out with you, and that would have been all I would have ever done. And I would be on my couch tonight watching reruns of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. And somebody else would be sharing with you. So for me, I came to believe that the power greater than myself, which would restore me to sanity, and for me, sanity is how I think. I've discovered my thinking is just a little skewed from the rest of the world, that I would be restored to right thinking through taking the action, the step. You see, I have lived my whole life trying to think my way into right living. That's never worked for me. Through taking the action, the steps, I have been able to act my way into right thinking. And that's what I came to believe would happen in step two. Step three, I hear people all the time saying they're having trouble with step three. Or they say, I'm on step three, and every day I get up and I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, except for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. Well, every day I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but by about noon I take it back. And, you know, I'm pretty sure those people don't understand the step, because the step says make a decision. Here's the decision. How do you want to live? Chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, or do you want to believe the people in AA are telling you the truth? Incomprehensible demoralization, hope. Despair, hope. It's not a difficult decision. I think I'll go with hope. But the decision, and the book talks about this very clearly, it says something to the effect that although the decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. The decision for me was the beginning of the surrender. But it didn't take, it had no impact on my life until I took an action. And for me, the first action was the fourth step. And I wrote the fourth step the way the big book says to do it. I made the columns. I wrote down everybody who I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. Wrote in the second column what they did to me. Well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. I was sorry I waited this long to do it. It was really fun. Third column, how it affected me. Well, it affected my security, my self-worth, my self-esteem. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd have drank too. Then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And after the diagram, hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at our part. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore, but... I did that with my resentments, my fears. in my relationships. And for the first time, I saw who Patio really was. You see, I spent my whole life putting on a show for you. Rationalization, justification, and denial. And when I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it, and when I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I have spent my whole life explaining it to you, hearing it, and believing it. My whole life was a show that I believed, and I had no idea who I really was until I did that fourth step. Then I looked at the fifth step and thought it was really, 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 really a good step for those of you who weren't raised Catholic. Those of us who are Catholic, we know about confession, and we know it doesn't work. So, I didn't have to do it. I wasn't going to do it. Put my fourth step in the trunk of my car, and I drove around with a continual sense of impending doom. And, of course, the fear was I'd be rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open. My fourth step would be everywhere, and I had, of course, put my first and last name on every page of that puppy. And I just envisioned it flying all over Southern California. And rather than do a fifth step, I just chose to drive around that way for a really long time. And what happened to me is, in retrospect, was interesting because you can go, I'm not suggesting this, so I'll just say it this way. I went a long time between step 4 and 5 by doing this. I would come to a meeting. By now, I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to a meeting every night. I have a sponsor who's a real pain in the ass. I'm thinking about firing her, but I'm, you know, looking around for a deaf mute to get instead. And I'm very active in AA, and I'm sharing at meetings, you know, and I'm discussion meetings, I'm sharing, and I'm feeling pretty good. But what it was like for me was this. I don't know if any of you have ever had a really old car that overheats. You got a car that overheats. If you pull over the side of the road and let the radiator cap off and let some of that steam come out, you can drive for a few more miles. But then it's overheating again. You got to let the radiator cap off, let some steam out. You can drive for a few more miles. And that's what I was doing in AA. I was sharing a little bit, and the meeting was like letting the steam off. I could go for a little while more. Then I'd let the steam off, and I could go for a little while more. But like the radiator, eventually, you got to drain the radiator, you got to fix it, and you got to refill it. And like that, I finally had to do a fifth step. And I didn't do it with my sponsor, because when God was ready, when it was my time, I was visiting a friend in Los Angeles, and we were talking. As we were talking, I realized I was doing a fifth step. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. And I got my fourth step out of the car, and I did my fifth step with her. And when I finished that big brick wall I had built between me and you, one brick came out of that wall. One lousy, crummy brick. But every time I've shared with another alcoholic, another brick has come out of that wall. And tonight I have no brick wall between me and you. One brick at a time. Now, I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up every once in a while. I went home from doing my fifth step. I did step 6 and 7 by mistake. I didn't mean to recover this quickly, but I just, by coincidence, opened the big book to the part where it talks about step 6 and 7, and I got lulled into reading it. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, that prayer took the longest journey anything has ever taken for me. The journey from my head to my heart. And I knew I believed it. And I finished reading that prayer, and what it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And I believe that's the miracle here. And I think too many people leave before the miracle happens. The miracle for me is I have an opportunity to walk away from the person I've been all of my life. And the best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But because the steps work and because you've been willing to share with me, I've become very gentle, very loving, very kind, very nurturing. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it. But I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. Steps 8 and 9 for me were conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took the drink. If it came between a job and a drink, I took the drink. If it came between anything and a drink, I took the drink. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. I felt guilty because I was guilty. And I became willing to make amends to the people on my list except for one. And I told my sponsor, under no uncertain terms, I will not make amends to my father. My father's a drunk, he's a Jekyll and Hyde drunk, and I was the target of his abuse. And I am not making amends to my father. And my sponsor told me that was fine. as long as you're willing to pay the price, that's fine. And I said, I'm willing. I don't want to go to the father-daughter banquet. I don't care. And I said about making my amends, and my amends for me were not about sorry. My amends were about living my life differently, and I don't know how to live it differently. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you share with me how to be an employee and not take a drink. And I go to work, and I try to do it the way you shared that you've done it. And I think my family's dysfunctional. I find out I'm the dysfunction. I don't know how to be a daughter, and I come and you share with me, and I go to my mother's house, and I try and live my life the way that you share with me that you live yours, and I don't take a drink. And every year of my life, I began to live my life differently. I began to live as if I wasn't selfish and self-centered, as if I wasn't grandiose, as if I didn't have the defects that I'd discovered. I began to live my life as if those defects had been removed. And living my life differently to make my amends, those defects began to lessen. I believe for me that God removes the defect by us living our lives in such a way as if the defect had been removed. And I began to get right with everybody in my life. Then, I'm very neurotic, then I noticed that I still don't have any friends, by the way, but I know that because they're a nuisance, quite frankly. People will see you on a Tuesday and they'll go, where were you Sunday? I tried to call you. And it's like, you know what, if I wanted you to know where I was, I would have told you before I went. You know, stop bothering me. But I'm noticing that other people in AA have friends. I'm finally noticing that, like, after a meeting, these groups of people are going out to coffee, and this group is going to a movie, and these people are talking about going to Denver for the weekend, and folks are, like, doing things together. They're being friends. And I'm thinking, and if you're neurotic, and you are if you're an alcoholic, pretty soon you're like, you want it. Whatever, you want it. Even if you didn't want it, you want it now. So I decide I need some friends. Well, this is how I decide who my friends are. You're sitting next to me three meetings in a row. You are now my friend. Now I have a friend. I'm really cool because now I got a friend. But then my friend does something to annoy me, like crack their gum or breathe too hard or accidentally kick me as they're crossing their legs. Well, now you can't be my friend anymore because you've irritated me. But now this person's been sitting next to me for two or three meetings. Now this person's my friend. Until they do something to irritate me, like breathe too hard or crack their gum. And now you can't be my friend anymore, but AA is a big place. You can get new friends every 3 or 4 days. And about every 4 or 5 days, I'm getting new friends because my friends are annoying me. I accidentally mentioned this to my sponsor. Not a good idea. Accidentally mentioned to my sponsor that the people... I'm trying to be friends with the people in AA, and they are annoying me. And my sponsor reminds me that I refused to make amends to my father. I said, Anne? She said, Patty, hate does not know that it's directed at one person. You cannot hate one person and not have that hate spill out into every other relationship in your life. Hate doesn't know it belongs to one person. I became willing to make amends to my father, not because I wanted to go to the father-daughter banquet. I became willing to make amends to my father because I wanted to have relationships with you. Doesn't matter what my motive is. What matters is what my actions are. And I began to do daughterly things with my father in order to make amends so that I could have friendships with you. And I need to tell you, I got people in my life today that have been friends of mine for years and years and years. I have friends who crack their gum. It still annoys me, but they can be my friends. I have people in my life who love me, and I can let them love me. I don't have to tell them how to do it. They love me the way they want to love me, and I love them. And you can't get here from where I was. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to have friends. I came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted. And if I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If a single day in the last 25 years I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. 10, 11, and 12 for me are the recovery steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it, ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? It seems to me when I'm focused on my problem, God can't do a thing with it. But when I turn my attention to you, God can come in and take care of my stuff. Selfish and self-centered is the nature of my disease. Through the action of the steps, I have been able to get to a place where today it's about you, it's no longer about me. Sometimes we tell new people, let us love you until you can love yourself. My message is, let us love you until you can love somebody else. Selfish and self-centered is what I need to move away from. Let us love you until you can love somebody else. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? Step 11, for me, I'm a very simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I'm so naive, I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. The rest of it is God's business. My prayer at night is a little scarier, and offer it to anybody who'd like to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. It keeps me from flipping people off on the freeway when they cut in front of me. It keeps me from counting the items of the person in front of me in the 10-item or less line and announcing it not only to the checkout person but to everybody in the grocery store. Please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. I happen to be a formal meditator. I love to meditate. There's a line in the book where it says we try to control and enjoy our drinking. I have to try and control and enjoy my meditation. I love to meditate. I am so spiritual when I am meditating alone. My difficulty is being with you. But I love to meditate. But you know, I get my best answers in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My best answers come from you. I come here and you share with me how you live your life and don't take a drink. And that's where I get my answers of how to live out there. Because you share how you live your life, how you go through being laid off, having jobs, having relationships and having deaths in the family, and you don't take a drink. And you share that with me. You give me the information I need to go out there and live. And that's what meditation is for me. It's getting the answers to live life to the fullest. Step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, the opportunity to give a little of this thing to another human being, to look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't have to live that way anymore a day at a time. My life today is absolutely incredible. My life today is beyond my wildest imagination. And I have a really wild imagination, but it is beyond anything that I could have planned for myself. If I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If you're new here tonight, go home tonight and write down what it is you expect to have happen to you in Alcoholics Anonymous and put that paper away. And next year when you're taking a cake for either 1 year or 12 months of sobriety, in California they're the same thing, but take that paper out and read it and find out if you'd had it your way, you'd have shortchanged yourself. If a single day in the last 25 years I'd had my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. Today I am right with everybody in my life. I am right with you, I'm right with me, and I'm right with God. And the testimony to that is I have the ability to nod out in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand because I've experienced it with that old man showed me on my fourth day of sobriety. I understand because I've experienced the serenity and the peace and the rightness inside of me. And I've had that privilege to experience it because you are here for me. It takes a tremendous amount of courage and strength to continue to choose to recover, and I don't have it. I don't have the courage and strength it takes to continue to choose to recover, but you do. And I come here, and when we pray tonight, the person on my right will give me the courage, and the person on my left will give me the strength. And you give me the courage and strength that I need in order to choose to recover another day. And you give the person next to you and the person next to you and the person next to you. And I'm going to end with this story because it's time to dance, and quite frankly, I have to use the restroom. I'm going to end with this story because it puts it together for me, and it's the story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he's to ask St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the door, but when they open the door, inside the room is a banquet, tables and tables and tables of food. Much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. But the people sitting in that room amongst all that food are dying. They're starving and they're hungry. And the reason that they're hungry is they have, you know those long wooden spoons that people who cook? I know how to make one thing. It's reservations. You know, but people who cook use those long wooden spoons and they're tied to their hands and the spoons are just a little bit too long and they can't quite get the food to their mouth. So they're sitting amongst plenty and they're starving. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. Then he takes him to a room marked heaven, and that room's the same thing. Tables and tables and tables of food. As much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And those people had those spoons tied to their hands too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the reason was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's... And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here and I have to let you feed me. And if I'm lucky, every once in a while I get to give a spoonful of this thing to another alcoholic. And you don't have to have 51 years or 20 years or 5 years or 1 year. If you have one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman coming through the door. If you have one day, you have the strength to give to the person on your left and you have the courage to give to the person on your right, in order that we can all continue to choose to recover. Of myself, I'm nothing. By myself, I can't do it. But with you, I can stay sober another day. Together, we can all stay sober one more day. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. And if I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And the thing I end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray God it's your experience. It's a line that we already heard in chapter 5, a line that says, "There is one who has all power." That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.